Good afternoon, Wallace Chapman with you on the panel. Thursday, Paula Penfold and Nick Leggett with me today, and thank you so much for all your responses. We will get to a lot more of the chivalry feedback maybe later on and tomorrow in the Friday mailbag. We've been inundated with those, but here is one. My husband often opens the door for me. I do know that this is a kindness, as he knows full well that as a sculptor, I'm very adept at handling an angle grinder and other such equipment, and I'm perfectly capable of managing anything thrown my way. That said, I totally get Paula's take on this. There is nothing worse than feeling patronised. And we're talking about open prisons later on in the program. Here's one. Open prisons are the ideal way to rehabilitate. That is the Scandinavian model, and 16% recidivism rates speak for itself. But our Department of Corrections is risk-averse, in my opinion. They would never be rational enough to do what works. First up on the program, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced today that Northland, Te Tai Tokoro, will drop down to the orange traffic light setting from midnight. Ms Ardern also provided more details on the government's broader response plan in the event of an Omicron outbreak. She says the whole country will move to red within 24 to 48 hours if there is any evidence of Omicron spreading in the community. Here she is.
We know from other countries that Omicron can take as little as 14 days for cases to grow from the hundreds into the thousands across the country. It is important to remember, though, that red does not mean lockdown or regional boundaries, and business remains open.
With us is Ngāti Hena Health Trust Chief Executive Jeff Milner. Kia ora, Jeff.
Tēnā koe, Wallace.
Nice to have you on. Now, is the right time for Northland to move to orange, in your opinion?
Well, based on the facts as we know them today, not on the facts of what might unfold in the future, I think the decision to move to orange was the right call. Northland is currently about 1,500 vaccinations shy of 90% first vaccinations. There's less than 26 contacts all across Northland. So in terms of what we're dealing with today and managing caseloads, I think the orange call was the appropriate call.
There is some concern there. We talked earlier on some afternoons with Tai Tokoro Border Control Group, Ruben Taipari, the coordinator. He's saying he's disappointed, that he's worried that they won't be able to protect the region's people. What would you say, Jeff?
Well, first of all, I think the Tai Tokoro Border Control Group have played a major and considerable part of where Northland hasn't seen an outbreak of Delta in terms of positive cases over the summer holidays. So first of all, Ruben and his group can take credit for their part in that. But the traffic light system is aimed at keeping Northland safe, aimed at keeping the health system able to respond. And as I sit here today, we are able to respond and vaccination process continues. So based on where we are today, I think the orange call and getting Northland into sync with the rest of New Zealand was the right call as we continue to do the hard work, including the likes of Tai Tokoro Border Control, encouraging those yet to engage in the vaccination program that it's not too late.
All right. Well, let's give our panel to jump in. Paula, your thoughts?
I think one thing that's becoming more and more clear each day is the shifting sands, and that, you know, policy made even a week or two ago will have to continually evolve. Policies announced today will probably have to evolve because everything is so unpredictable. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the traffic light settings and each of those divisions of the traffic light settings have to be altered as Omicron does inevitably arrive on our shores and we figure out how it's spreading and what the impact of that is. Everything is still evolving.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think that's the right approach. So when I advocate that I think the decision today is the right one, that's what we're dealing with today. And as Paula said, what we're dealing with tomorrow or indeed next week, the system, the settings and everything needs to respond to that. Now, that means Northlanders will still live in an environment of uncertainty. But, you know, we listen and read the news about Omicron. And so we need to retain an open mind and flexible to change those settings. But for today, the health system is coping. It's still working. there is no widespread Delta outbreak in Northland beyond what we can handle. So today, the decision is appropriate, in my opinion.
Nick Leggett.
I thought that the Prime Minister's wider messages were really useful. I think it was timely for the country to hear from her in terms of the fact that Omicron is not going to be a walk in the park. And I think she was realistic in some of what she was, well, in all of what she was saying. It's interesting, I'm unsure from what she, from her wording is if she thinks that we will need to go into lockdown again. But look, I work in an industry that's really crying out for some certainty, because of course trucking is going to be very important again in any outbreak and any lockdown. And you know, businesses that supply food and medical equipment and require them to be transported do need information on how to get access to rapid antigen without the government necessarily distributing them. And will there be, is there potential for wage subsidies? And what will the stand down periods be from work for those people that, you know, may test positive? Because what we've seen is workforces in transport and trucking decimated overseas for periods, and we're starting our scenario planning. And so it's going to be really important for the government to share that over the next week or two, if we have that amount of time with this. There is significant uncertainty. And actually, what we've shown in transport with the other two lockdowns is you can plan for some scenarios, and we just want to know if the government's with us on that.
Yeah, in terms of the planning, Jeff, and in terms of the broader Omicron response, I mean, we heard a few more details today, didn't we, including moving to red within 24 to 48 hours of any sign of a community transmission. Are you heartened by the response plan? Is there anything that Northland uniquely needs in terms of preparation on the ground if this transmission really takes hold?
Yeah, first of all, what I would add is that either individuals in Northland, the health system in Northland, you know, we shouldn't be waiting for the government to dish up to us what we need to be doing today or tomorrow. We need to take the initiative and get on with the work we know needs to be done, deal with the things we can influence, and don't spend a lot of time in the areas we can't influence. And so I think for Northland, you know, the Omicron shadow that is hovering over Aotearoa is we have been blessed to a certain extent with a window to get some things done, and we can't muck up this window around booster vaccinations, pediatric vaccinations, or I think from the government, the messaging needs to be to the people is start making preparations individually for how you might need to isolate. I think personally the mask debate needs to ramp up if it
right.
is N95 masks that we need to use.
Yeah.
Not many households can access those masks in Northland, so let's use this time to get that masking available for individuals that unless it's provided, they just won't wear.
Kia ora, Jeff. Thank you for your time. That's Jeff Milner from Ngāti Hēne Health Trust Chief Executive. There's a few things there, isn't there, Paula? It's really it's a funny scenario, isn't it? Because it's preparing for an oncoming storm, if you like, isn't it? So you can see it coming across the horizon. You just don't know when it's going to land on the shores. In terms of the psychological response, is quite unique.
It is in terms of the psychological response. I'm quite interested to see the number of people who, you know, and obviously they're in a privileged position to be able to even contemplate this, but the number of people who say that even without any instruction from government, they'll be kind of self-imposing a sort of a lockdown because they don't want to be exposed to it. So, psychologically, that's a whole different story, isn't it, apart from the physical effects of this, how it's affecting people mentally and how they're dealing with even the prospect of it, let alone what actually happens when it, as I said before, inevitably hits, is, there are people who are quite scared. And that's not surprising, but, you know, because all of the talk about it being mild, is fine. But the point is, it might be mild for most people. A, there are some for whom it won't be mild. It will be serious. It will be fatal. And B, when it's in the numbers that countries are experiencing overseas, a lot of mild cases means that there will be numbers that do risk putting our health system under enormous pressure. And so some of the language that we were seeing at the very beginning of this pandemic is relevant again, isn't it, in terms of things like flattening the curve.
Nick, before we move on, I just want to sort of get your response, because, and it's good to have you on here, because one of the things I have seen in Australia, and it's stark and it's quite amazing to see those shelves being gutted out, no supplies, and not because of panic buying necessarily, but because those trucks cannot get the wares to the shops. Why? Because people are isolating because they perhaps have COVID or have tested positive. How prepared are you?
I think the industry is as prepared as it can be. And it's thinking about things like splitting shifts, so one part of the workforce doesn't see another, and for a period of time to avoid infection. It's also recognising, and this is why I said, you know, that stand-down period is so important, because originally in places like the US, it was 10 days if you tested positive, you couldn't go back to work. That was reduced to 5, because if somebody was essentially asymptomatic, because it's so important to get people back to the workforce. And trucking, as Dr. Ashley has said, is actually low risk for transmission because it's quite a solitary role. And as you've identified, it's vital. But it's all those, also the food manufacturers and all those sort of people, they're all going to be potentially impacted by this. And they are doing their planning too. But what we need is some certainty, all of us, around the rules that the government is thinking about. And that ability and that access to testing is going to be really important as well.
18 past four, you're on the panel, RNZ National. You can text us on 2101, email thepanel@rnz.co.nz. Well, a third Navy ship will be sent to Tonga tomorrow to aid in the relief efforts following the weekend's eruption of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano. Water being among the highest priorities for Tonga, and Aotearoa, the HMNZS Aotearoa, can carry 250,000 litres, produce 70,000 litres per day through a desalination plant. That's what Minister Nanaia Mahuta said. Now, Luluwai Wallace Hunter is based in Queensland, has family in Tonga, who says she will never forget the sound during a call to family in Tonga. Luluwai Wallace Hunter is with us now. Malo Alele, Luluwai, welcome to the panel.
Oh, thank you.
You were making a video call to Tonga when the eruption hit. Explain that a bit for us.
Well, we were doing a video call meeting with some of our admin, because we have a non-profit group that we are meeting to discussing our donation to help help for the kids going back to school. While we were talking, and we can hear the thunder, the noise. It's like a war zone. It's happened in Tonga.
You mentioned, I think, too, that you heard the stones hitting the roof at the time of the call.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff that was going on.
Yeah, it's going on. And while we were talking, they say it's raining. And then we can hear, like, when I hear the sound, it sounds like hailstorm. But then we're running outside and they're showing us It's from the volcano.
Luluwai, your auntie's house is just on the shoreline, am I right?
Yes, that's correct.
You've been able to make contact with family again, or so far?
Not with my family, but one of the admin in Tonga, that where we talking and while the volcano erupted. I finally get hold on to her last night.
So, yes, quite a serious situation. Now, tell us more, a little bit about this non-profit group called, is it Oniwane Hakotapu?
Yes, that's correct. It's a non-profit a group that we helping the Tongan back home for, like, people, like, they need help, like, sending food or helping the kids. Some they don't afford the kids going back to school, so we are helping them buying school supplies and paying their school fees.
Oh, very good. Lula, while we've got a panel with us, they might want to jump in with a question or a comment. Paula Penfold?
Yes.
I just wondered about that communication, you know, with the difficulty with being able to speak directly with your family. Are you getting any indication yet from officials about means of facilitating that communication? Because I know so many people are so worried, and until they can speak with family members directly, that worry really won't go away.
Yes, because the problem is some people, they don't understand the communication in Tonga. Because the digital, they're explaining it's only 10%, you know, it's working at the moment, and even I try the whole day yesterday, I can't get through until like midnight last night in my time. That's where I go through to one of our admin, and the things that I hear from her voice is the dear of joy that I can hear her, and then I ask, are you guys all right? Yes, and she said to me, they are all right. The only things that she worry about, because the volcano is not dying, is still active. Mm-hmm. And the main thing they really want is water.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Water and non-perishable food are the messages we're getting here. Is that, would you agree?
Yes, and the water they're drinking now is the tap water. It's the underground water. They are boiling that water and putting it in the fridge or like so they can drink. But they need, like what they say, they need rain to wash off the ashes and things so they can eat something. But at the moment, the water is the main priority for them.
The water's the main thing at the moment. Nick, do you want to come in on this? Nick Leggett.
I just wonder if you're able to tell us, how's the level of public support for the work you're trying to do, and are you getting a good response in terms of getting donations and of either goods or money?
Back here in Townsville, the community and they're trying to work together with the defense, the Minister of Defense over here. If Tonga need help, they are ready to go and send some donation and whatever Tonga need. But at the moment, yes. Tonga need some help. They don't have enough. Like in here, we have a lot of machine and a lot of stuff to do the cleaning. But in Tonga, they just hand by hand and work together. Mm. Without machine or what, at least they work together and try to clean up the mess.
Well, all the very best, Luluai, to you and whānau. But before you go, actually, from what you know and from what you've made the slim contact with family in Tonga, how are they faring? How are they going?
Well, I haven't go through yet. I go through with someone, like what I say, the one of the admin of our non-profit group. But I'm trying every single minute, every single second that I can check all of my family's number, whoever I can go connect to them, so I can ask, are you guys all right, you know? But I know for sure they are, you know, they need help, but the things they will say, we are okay. That's the only word you can hear from anyone I know. Because we never experienced that things happen in our life. But, yeah, when you ask them, are you guys, yeah, we are all right. But I know for sure they need, you know, they need help.
They need help, yeah. Thank you, Lulu. I appreciate it. That's Lulu Wallace-Hunter there, based in Queensland, trying to get in touch with her family in Tonga. 27 past 4, the panel, RNZ National. Nice to be with you today. Very different topic here to a fundraiser with a difference. 24-hour share-a-thon. The event planned for February will raise money for the Southland Charity Hospital in Invercargill in memory of Winton man Blair Vining, who died of bowel cancer in 2019. The organiser of the share-a-thon, Jared Moneyheader, a PGG Rights and Will rep from Alexandra, he's with us now. Jared, kia ora, nice to have you on the panel.
Kia ora, and thanks for having me on.
24 hours of sharing sounds tough. That's all I can think about.
It's going to be a big ask, and it's going to be tough on the boys' body and minds. But they're up. They're looking forward to the challenge. And they're actually excited now. It's getting pretty close to crunch time.
Right. So you've got four shearers, real pros, I understand?
Yep. So one of our shearers is Udu Weeds. So he's a two-time record holder.
Yep. Yeah. So just what sort of preparation, what does it take to, from what I understand, we've talked to shearers before on the show, that this is really tough work. But 24 hours, what does it take?
Oh, it's going to take, they've had to do a lot of gym work, diets. So we've got the catering staff that'll be doing their meals. They've been working with them to see what different meals they want at different times for themselves. And I think the battle's going to be their minds, because it's going to get to some point in it where their bodies are going to want to give up and their minds have to take over and actually tell them to keep pushing through it.
Our panel will have questions too, but one thing that really comes to mind for me, Jared, is how people in the region really galvanise around this Southland Charity Hospital, in memory of Blair Vining. It's a real lightning rod for support, isn't it?
It is, and it's been pretty amazing that, after Blair passed away, that Melissa Vining didn't give up, she didn't stop, and she's just pushed through, and, none of this would have happened if she didn't carry on and pushing through and do what Blair wanted. I suppose the dream that Blair had, she's turned it into a reality.
Yeah. Paula?
It just sounds like an amazing event. I can imagine what the vibe and mood must be like at it, because it's obviously such an incredible cause. But I'm interested in what you're saying about how the thing that's problematic, because it's hard enough for 24 hours to even be awake, let alone do all that work, and that it's the mental thing that is, kind of more problematic than the physical thing. So what do they do? What do you all do to help them get through that?
Well, I just support them. So they'll have their own support crew that'll be with them. We've got seven massagers coming in, some girls that on their hour breaks, they'll rub them down and get them up and hopefully up and going again. But just be there if they need anything. Their support crew will tell us and we'll get it done for them.
Nick?
It's just trying to make it easy for them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the stamina of these guys will be amazing. But also, as Wallace said, the way the community's come together. I'm interested to know, in terms of drawing attention and fundraising, is there a focus among the organisers around prevention of bowel cancer and early testing?
I actually haven't asked them about that, but my take on it, so the reason I got behind this is I lost my father in 2019 to brain cancer, but back in 2011 he had prostate cancer. He got his prostate removed and went into remission, and then he actually came off the bike and they realised he had brain cancer for years that they didn't pick up on. And I look at it as if someone can bypass the public system and get into this hospital, it's money worth paid for. Prevention's better than cure for me.
Kia ora, Jared. Really nice to be with you this afternoon and to help give this 24-hour share-a-thon a bit of a leg up. Not that you necessarily need it, but for those folks out there listening who weren't aware of it and maybe not in the Southland region, how can someone donate?
So we've got a Facebook page set up called Share for Blair. The bank details for the charity, Southland Charity Hospital, are on that. And we're also going to be live streaming the full event with the bank details that people, if they watch and want to donate, they can donate as it goes.
Very, very good. That's Jared Moneyheader, a wool rep from Alexandra, organiser of this 24-hour share-a-thon. Anybody in the around the panel been part of a sharing gang at some part of their lives, either Paul or Nick?
No, but no, I have watched the sheriff before.
No, it sounds pretty tough.
It's a great smell, though, and I've only ever reported on it. I remember reporting on the golden shears back in Wairarapa.
Yeah.
I love the smell, that kind of lanolin mixed with whatever it is. Yeah.
Just on this charity hospital, Paula, it's amazing that it's taken on a life of its own. It's actually become a thing, and one hopes that it is a sustainable model, that there is enough money to pay staff, surgeons to come in for however long. Let's hope that it's a thing that really is really built into the community for a long-term thing.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I didn't know about it until I saw the information about this share-a-thon. So it's clearly there's a need in Southland. Yeah. The problems in terms of cancer particularly down there have been so bad, haven't they? So there's obviously a need, and all power to them. It's an incredible initiative. It's sad that it's necessary, but clearly it is.